Hello, in this audio snippet, we would like to talk about several different topics or ideas, and but I do believe that all these miscellaneous ideas are interrelated. There's a thread running through all of them. So, first of all, we'd like to tie a loose end or finish talking about something we had started talking about in the previous recording related to the Great Fire of London in 1666. It has to do with the man who was accused of starting the fire and who was in fact hanged shortly after the fire, and his name is well, in English you would pronounce it Robert Hubert, but the fellow was a Frenchman, so you might have to pronounce it something like Robert Hubert or something like that. But let's stick with the English pronunciation because it's a little easier. Robert Hubert apparently was born in 1640, and he was, according to a PDF file that is available from the Museum of London.org.uk, according to this document, Robert Hubert was a French Protestant from Normandy. He was arrested at Romford after the Great Fire on suspicion of attempting to flee the country. He was the son of a watchmaker. It says here, Robert Hubert was a French Protestant born in Rouen, Rouen, Normandy in 1640 to a watchmaker. So, for some reason, which I do not know, Robert Hubert decided to come to arrive in London from France, I gather, or from some other place. But he, obviously, he started in France and ended up in England, and then he got caught up in the whole fire situation and was found guilty and hanged. And it says here that Hubert's confession, I'm reading from the Wikipedia article now on Robert Hubert. Hubert's confession at first was of starting a fire in Westminster. However, this story proved unsatisfactory, and his confession changed upon learning that the fire never reached Westminster. Having learned that the fire started in Pudding Lane in the house of the baker Thomas Farner, he then claimed to have thrown a crude fire grenade through the open window of the Farner bakery. He claimed to have acted with accomplices, and the PDF from the Museum of London website says that the number of conspirators was 23, which is interesting. 23 conspirators, supposedly, and he was supposedly one of them. So I'm reading back in the Wikipedia article. He claimed to have acted with accomplices who stopped the watercocks to sabotage the effort to put out the fire. Hubert's confessed motive was apparently that he was a French spy and an agent of the Pope, which seems to contradict a little bit what the Museum of London PDF says, that he was a Protestant. So why would he be acting on behalf of the Catholic Pope? So it says here in the Wikipedia article, Hubert's confessions never seemed convincing. His retroactive change of story to fit the facts, though, was not the only reason. Hubert had not even been in London at the time that the fire broke out. He had not even arrived in England until 2 days after the fire started. That he was not in the country at the time of the outbreak of fire is not in doubt, as testified years later by a captain of the Swedish ship the Maid of Stockholm, that he personally had landed Hubert ashore 2 days after the outbreak of the fire. Having never seen the Farner bakery, Hubert also did not know that it had no windows. What is more, he was judged so severely crippled that it would have been impossible for him to throw the claimed grenade. Hubert's confession is often attributed to mental simplicity, an inability to understand what it was he was doing, a kind of, quote, confessing Sam tendency. One source claims, though, that the confession was coerced, quote, probably by an extreme form of torture. The article on Wikipedia goes on to talk about, the fact that in London at that moment in time, there was a need for a scapegoat, someone to blame the fire on, and especially someone who was a foreigner. Hubert, unfortunately, being a foreigner and a Frenchman, which made it even worse for him, being in England, made him into the perfect scapegoat. And the jury, it says here, a few of the jury at his trial actually believed Hubert guilty. One contemporary account claims that Hubert was, quote, only accused upon his own confession, yet neither the judges nor any present at the trial did believe him guilty, but that he was a poor, distracted wretch, weary of his life, and chose to part with it in this way, unquote. The jury stated that he did not have, quote, the fear of God before his eyes, but was moved and led away by the instigation of the devil, unquote. So the thing is that the jury didn't really believe him to be guilty because his confession didn't make sense. It had changed. It seemed to be adjusting to the facts as he learned them. He said he threw a grenade through the window of the bakery, but the bakery had no windows. At the beginning, he said that he had started the fire in Westminster, and the fire never reached Westminster. So it was constantly changing, and no one believed it, but even so, they sentenced him to death, which is kind of strange. So it seems like this person had some sort of mental incapacity, or something that prevented him defending himself. So he just accepted the guilt and just willingly confessed. It's as if he was looking for a way to die, or maybe he was being tortured. Who knows? I really have no understanding on what the meaning of this man is in the context of everything. But I'm still puzzled. What was he doing in England, being from France? Why was he there to begin with? And apparently he arrived in England on a Swedish ship, the Museum of London PDF indicates, if I'm not mistaken, that he had declared that he had arrived from Sweden as part of a plot. It says here, he confessed to starting the fire, claiming to be one of 23 conspirators. He said he'd gone to Sweden with a Stephen Peidloe, and returned to London in August. Stephen Peidloe had apparently taken him to Pudding Lane on the 2nd of September, and he had put a fireball through the window of Thomas Farner's bakery. So why did he go to Sweden and then return to London? I don't know. There's a lot of strange stuff going on there, and the connection to Sweden I find very interesting. Especially because of the posting, the last posting that the article posted on the website where these recordings are posted, where in that last article we talk a lot about Sweden. So I think it's all related somehow. But the thing is that after this strange trial, where the jury didn't believe him but convicted him only because of his own confession, which was very questionable, he was hanged. And the interesting thing to me is that the fire happened on the second, between the 2nd and the 5th of September of 1666. They caught this guy and made him to confess. And then they tried him, found him guilty. And then he was hanged at, it says here, at Tyburn, London, on the 27th of October, 1666. So just like that, you know, less than 1.5 months later, the fellow was dead. Which is kind of ironic when you compare it with the people who are in death row in America. It's interesting, I saw this or was watching this story on someone who had committed a crime. He was sentenced to death, and the story said he was executed 27 years after he was sentenced to death. And that is typical, and I don't know why the number 27 is showing up. He was hanged on the 27th of October of 1666. And 27, we mentioned before, is a number of one short of completion. So who knows what all of this means, but it's interesting that they didn't take 27 years to kill him. They killed him very quickly after they sentenced him to death. So I just wanted to mention that, and there's something to that story about this sacrificial scapegoat that that has some sort of relevance. I still don't quite understand it, but the fact that he was French, he arrived from Sweden, and he gave this confession just almost adjusting his confession to maximize his chances of being found guilty. It's all very, very peculiar. And this person apparently had some sort of, maybe he was mentally retarded. Maybe he had some form of retardation. And it kind of correlates, let's say, with America, you know, the mental retardation that we have had collectively as a society, and if you have doubts about it, just look at the way we so easily complied with all the mask mandates and all the mRNA injections without looking at the science, without thinking it through, without applying common sense and logic, and instead just following superstition. We were told this is the way it is, and we just accepted it, just like maybe this Robert Hubert or Robert Hubert, who was told, no, you started the fire like this, and he just went, oh yes, that's how I started the fire. It just goes to the fact that there's a connection between the destruction of the fire and a spirit or mindset of simplicity, of excessive simplicity. The fire that started in America, or the final stages of that fire, involved a whole generation of stupid, moronic Americans, which just lived in a total mindset of simplicity, accepting everything that their, quote, leaders told them without questioning it, without analyzing it, without believing it, just accepting superstition and treating it as fact just because certain people said it. So we felt the need to share about this fellow, Robert Hubert, and I know there's something there, I'm just not quite grasping it, but I think the concept of simplicity is related there, the need for a sacrificial scapegoat, and so forth, but I don't understand much beyond that. And the other thing that we wanted to share related to what we talked about in the previous audio recording is regarding this young lady, Ambrose, that we talked about. I had failed to mention that in all the television adverts, the commercials for the St. Jude Hospital that I've seen, it's all every time they show a kid, it's always a kid who is fighting cancer and surviving it. And it's interesting that this young lady, Ambrose, is the only example I've seen of the many St. Jude's Hospital adverts where they talk about a person who did not make it, who did not survive the cancer. Because obviously, if you want to advertise the benefits of supporting this hospital, you want to talk about the success stories. So it's interesting that they chose a person who did not succeed, who did not defeat the cancer, and who won the first time back in 2012, but then had a relapse and then passed away in 2020, if I remember correctly, or 2021, I believe. She got sick again in 2020, right before the pandemic, and then she passed away, if I remember correctly, either at the end of that year, later that year, or at the start of 2021. But I believe that's the fact that they featured her, and her name is Ambrose. It's just this emphasis on how she represents the death of the American dream, of the beauty of America and its hope, and how it's like we were given a second chance, but unfortunately we did not do what needed to be done to rescue the beauty of that American dream. Now that we've mentioned those two things from the previous recording, we'd like to talk about some seemingly unrelated things. One is something we wanted to talk about before, but we didn't, but the time ran out. And it has to do with Trump. And so let me go to an article posted on AP, the Associated Press. And always, if you read anything from the Associated Press, you always have to take it with a grain of salt, because the Associated Press is a very left-wing news outlet, very biased towards the left. But even so, it does provide some sort of news information every now and then. So we wanted to read from this article on the Associated Press. Their website is apnews.com. And this article was posted on the 15th of September. So it was in the midst of the death of America. And I don't remember what state died on the 15th of September. I believe it was, let me see if I have it here. It would have been the state of Connecticut. That was the colony of Connecticut, and what Connecticut represents was dying that day. Connecticut represented the conquering attitude in the North. There were three states in the North, three states in the South, that or three colonies in the North and three colonies in the South that died after the first seven colonies that represent the seven personalities, you could say. On the 15th, Connecticut died, which represented the conqueror personality in the North. And it's interesting that we're talking about a conqueror here, who in this case, Donald Trump. The article says Donald Trump isn't backing a national abortion ban that is not hurting him in the GOP primary. So, excuse me. So I'm going to read here. This was posted on the 15th of September. And one of the authors of the article is called Thomas, which is interesting. We've been talking about the name Thomas a lot. Thomas Beaumont. And Beaumont is kind of French for beautiful mountain. And I know that means something. So it says here, Donald Trump is dominating the early stages of the Republican presidential primary, even as he's refused to endorse a federal ban on abortion, allowing some top rivals to get to the right of him on an issue that animates many conservative activists. It says a little bit later here, but Trump has so far declined to go along with some of his rivals, most notably his one-time vice president, Miguelito Pence, but doesn't say Miguelito, but that's how I call him, who is pushing for national bans that would take effect relatively early into a pregnancy. He's warned Republicans against locking themselves into positions that are unpopular with the majority of the public, and has argued that the Supreme Court's decision gives abortion opponents the right to, quote, negotiate, unquote, restrictions where they live rather than rely on federal curbs. So this is what, so even Miguelito Pence is pushing for national bans. And the ban would be kind of like early into the pregnancy. So, but Trump on the other hand is saying, he's telling Republicans, don't lock yourselves into a position that is unpopular with the majority of the public. And then he saw the Supreme Court decision when Roe v. Wade was overturned. He said, this decision gives abortion opponents the right to, quote, negotiate restrictions. And when I read that, it just stirred me to wrath. Because it goes to this same problem he has, this stupid reliance on the art of the deal, his constant belief that he can negotiate himself to victory, because that's the way he's operated in the business world, and he believes that that is the rule, the way to go with everything. So let me change the word abortion to slavery and read that sentence again. So he has argued that the Supreme Court's decision gives slavery opponents the right to negotiate restrictions on slavery where they live rather than rely on federal curbs. If you try to change that to slavery, I hope you see how outrageous the sentence becomes, at least in terms of evidently outrageous. If slavery is wrong, then you don't want to negotiate the end of slavery. You don't want to say, okay, we're going to negotiate on these terms. You can we'll allow you to keep 20% of your slaves, and you must let go the other 80%. But as opposed to forcing you to surrender 100% of your slaves, so let's negotiate. Or, for example, you can keep a person as slave until the age of 30, and after that, you have to let them go. That's negotiating. You know, it's like, okay, you want to kill some people in my family? Just kill my youngest daughter and that niece over there, because I don't like her too much. And but leave the rest of my family alive. You don't negotiate when it's something precious and holy and valuable, and when there you have the clear conviction of principle, you don't negotiate that. You stand on that principle and you become radical about it. And Trump constantly keeps calling the left and the abortionists radicals, and yes, they are radicals. And he says, "But I'm not a radical. I negotiate. I I believe that you have to be reasonable about it. I'm not radical like they are. And the problem is, no, you have to be radical too, just to be radical on the right side. There's nothing wrong with being radical about the truth. It's the problem is when you're radical about what, you know, about a falsehood. But standing in the middle ground between truth and falsehood, just because you don't want to be radical, is unacceptable either. Or it's wrong, it's destructive. That's why the country's dead, because of attitudes like that. And we talked about this, you know, this reticence to be radical or to make no compromise. And it's interesting, as I was thinking about these things before this recording, I had the television on and it was on mute. And I looked up as I was thinking about this, you know, no compromising. And then I looked up and there was a commercial going on, and they put these big words, no compromises. And it turns out, and the person who was speaking was, that I could see was speaking because the television was muted, but the person who was on camera was Drew Barrymore, an actress who is famous or well-known for her leftist, left-wing leanings and political views, and she was doing this advert, this commercial for some sort of product that doesn't apparently doesn't require big containers and is friendly to the environment. So that's kind of where they were going with the no compromises, like we are pro environment and we're going to be radical about it, and this product doesn't make any compromises. It makes every effort to save the environment and hug the trees and save the polar bears and all that. And I have nothing against the product per se. I don't even know what the product is. But my point is that they, the left, when they are convinced of something, they say, they take the no holds barred mentality. No compromises. We'll do whatever it takes to win and get our victory in our for our point of view. And the problem is that people, the conservatives, are not like that. And the problem is conservatism is inherently stagnant. It forces you to think in terms of maintaining the status quo. You can't be radical about maintaining the status quo. Or you can't have a radical attitude that leads to true transformation, because you are playing defense all the time. You never go on offense, because you always just want to hold everything at bay. And this was very disheartening, very angering to hear that he wants to negotiate restrictions. So he saw this big victory, the overturning of Roe v. Wade, as a way to use it as leverage in his art of the deal, to negotiate restrictions where people live rather than rely on federal curbs. Like, we don't want a federal ban on slavery. Let's go back to the slavery analogy. No, we don't want a federal ban on slavery. No, we want people where they live to decide what to do with slavery. If you are opposed to slavery, that is nonsense. And because we constantly live in that state, we had the Missouri Compromise and all these compromises we kept doing during the 19th century, it became untenable. And then we had to fight a war where 600,000 Americans had to lose their lives in order to finally end the compromise and do the right thing. And even then, we started compromising immediately after that. We had the 1876 compromise that we talked about before in that election. And then we sold black people down the river again. So it's like we returned them to slavery, but in a more subtle way in the South. The thing is that you don't negotiate, you don't compromise, you evangelize. That's what you have to do. You don't negotiate. You don't compromise. You evangelize. Let me continue reading the article here. It says here, but Trump, who said again Friday that the Supreme Court ruling, quote, moves the issue back to the states where it should be, unquote, has repeatedly criticized fellow Republicans for the way they talk about the issue. So again, he's doing the federalism solution, you know, the states, leave it up to the states. And as we've mentioned a million times, federalism is one of these threads or underlying currents that led to the death of America about a month ago. So, but he's, you know, these people are dead. Trump is spiritually dead. He is dead. So, and the country is dead, and all the people who are trying to bring the country back to life, that who don't want to understand the country's dead, all these people are still stuck in that mindset, in the mindset that led to the country's death. And it's just confirmation. There is no turning back. The country's dead and will never recover. It says here, he argues it could be, it could benefit the party politically if candidates learn to speak about it differently by highlighting Democratic positions that are out of the political mainstream. Again, he says, just start talking about how radical the Democrats are and how sensible and compromising we are. That's his attitude. It says here, I want to get to a section that I saw earlier, and I apologize. I'm trying to find this. Okay, here we go. Mike Damastus, D-E-M-A-S-T-U-S, Mike Damastus, is an evangelical Christian in Des Moines who was part of a private meeting this summer between Trump and a group of pastors and asked Trump about abortion. Quote, his response to me was, I've given you leverage now to make a better deal, unquote, recalled Damastus, who supports some form of a federal ban but isn't ruling out backing Trump even if he doesn't. So again, how arrogant, stupid son of a bitch. Trump saying, I have given you leverage now to make a better deal. Oh, I gave you leverage. I made this possible, and now we can negotiate the art of the deal. So he's thinking in terms of negotiation, like this is a business deal, instead of speaking in terms of principle. And the arrogance of it, he doesn't realize that, yes, he put enough judges in the Supreme Court for this to happen, but it happened because of things that the truth seekers were doing behind the scenes that made it possible to even reach that point. He doesn't understand that. He thinks he was so brilliant. And he put all these people who are, a lot of them, you know, big disappointments, but he got lucky enough to have abortion overturned, but it was because of other things going on behind the surface that he will never he will not understand until after he's dead, and meets his maker. But the thing is that it says here, Pence, whom Trump picked as his number two, in part because of his credibility with social conservatives, has declared that every Republican running for president should endorse, at a minimum, a federal abortion ban 15 weeks into pregnancy. So now they're starting to talk numbers, 15 weeks. So, excuse me, but if that fetus is a living being whose life, who has a right to life and whose life needs to be protected, why is it, does it, can only be protected until after 15 weeks? So if it's 14 weeks and 6 days, can we kill that thing? or why 14 weeks and 6 days? So it is mind-boggling, the stupidity of these people. So this guy, at least, is Miguelito Pence, is supporting a federal ban, so he's not compromising all the way Trump is. But why 15 weeks? So at 14 weeks and 3 days, let's kill that sucker, you know, and let's throw it in the dumpster, and we're done. But after 15 weeks, oh, now it's holy. Life is holy and sacred and sacrosanct, whatever. Let's protect it. Why 15 weeks? What is the metaphysical foundation for that number? Where is it coming from? See, the things that we've talked about before, about the right to life, these are fundamental metaphysical principles that we laid out, characteristics of life that we laid out in previous recordings, that define or allow us to give us a sense of what the right to life is. Once we have those metaphysical principles, then we can define, okay, let's protect all forms of life, including animal life. We kept talking about the importance of that. And then once you include the right to life of animals, then the extension into the right to life of fetuses, of human fetuses, it's just like a natural continuation of the same logic. And then you can say you protect the fetus. Then once you protect you declare that living thing is a living thing that has a right to life and that needs to be protected, then you're done. It doesn't really matter how many weeks that thing has been in the woman's womb. Now, I'm using the word thing in a just to emphasize how these people objectify the fetus. I'm talking about the conservatives. Objectify the fetus. You're objectifying it if you're putting a limit of 15 weeks. But no, once the conception has happened, once the sperm has fertilized the egg, there's a life, and then there's a magical, almost magical expansion of this life begins to grow, and then a few weeks on, then the thing is so alive that you can see it in an ultrasound or whatever, and sometimes they start, you know, playing football or soccer, kicking the womb, reacting to the sound of their parents. That thing is alive. It's living. So if you understand the metaphysical foundation, then you lay out the metaphysical foundation, and on that you say, okay, the conclusion is, well, we protect life. But this is all pragmatic nonsense, just random number. You know, did he go to the bathroom one day and did the number 15 come out? And he looked at it and picked it out of the toilet bowl and said, okay, 15, that's the number I'm going to go with. Where the hell did that number come from? There is no justification for it. It is nonsense. Then another guy from South Carolina, Senator Tim Scott, also making a push to appeal to Iowa evangelical voters, concurs with Pence. He recently criticized fellow South Carolinian Nikki Haley, who says Republicans should look for bipartisan consensus on abortion since stricter federal bans won't clear Congress. See, the thing is, oh, it's not feasible, hence we're not going to aim for it. You don't think that way. You fight for the right thing and fight to gain as much ground as you can. You know, if the Japanese come in Pearl Harbor, the Japanese come and invade American territory or attack American territory, then you decide, okay, if the enemy has invaded my land, I'm going to go and fight them off as much as I can and beat them out of my land as much as you can. Now, oh, let's not fight because we can't beat them all. We can't drive them all the way out of our country. You don't think that way. You fight as much as you can, and you push them back as far as you can. You don't think in terms of, can I do it? Can I not do it? It's like somebody come breaking into your house and starting to shoot up your family members. You don't go, okay, can I defeat him? Can I not defeat him? it's not worth fighting because I'm not going to be able to save my entire family. So what's the point? No, you fight back to defend as many of your family members as possible. If some of them die, well, you know, that doesn't mean you shouldn't have fought at all. But you don't aim for, okay, I'm going to settle for three of my family members dying and the other five, you know, okay, you know, I'll keep them alive, but I'm willing to let three of them go. No, you aim for zero deaths in your family. You aim for your entire family to be saved and then battle as hard as you can. You don't have this mentality where, oh, it's not going to clear Congress. No, you do the right thing. And these people claim to believe in God. I mean, Tim Scott, I think, is a Christian. Pence claims to be a Christian. Who knows what the hell he is. But the thing is that these people claim to be Christians. Don't you think that they would believe in a supernatural power coming and creating? If, you know, if you build it, he will come. You know, that sort of mindset. Lift up the rod and the reed sea will part. You know, that sort of thing, that sort of attitude. Just lift up the rod. In the Bible, it says Moses stood before the Reed Sea. And I say Reed Sea because that's how it says what it says in the Hebrew. It doesn't say Red Sea, it says Reed Sea. But that's a minor point. The thing is, when he's standing in front of the Reed Sea, the Bible says that God told him, lift up your rod. So he had to lift it up. And once he lifted it up, it says in the Bible that the Reed Sea parted. It's the same way. You build it, and if he's real, he will come, and he will fight for you. You don't assume that you've lost the battle unless you really don't believe in your God. If it's all just a product of your imagination, then forget about it. But it says here... But entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy opposes national bans in favor of state restrictions. And other major candidates have been noncommittal. That includes Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who often answers questions about a federal ban by saying his state recently passed a ban on abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy. So again, he said 6 weeks. Why six? Did he go to the bathroom right after Miguelito Pence, and did the number six come out of his butt? And he said, okay, that's the number that I'm going to go with. You know, and you could argue, well, you know, that's all you could get. Well, then say it. You know, I wanted 0 weeks, but I couldn't get the vote for that, so I had to settle for six. But it's a big disappointment. But we still are aiming for zero. I mean, if you phrase it that way, that's different. But he's so proud. 6 weeks. So a fetus that is 5 weeks and 6 days old. Yeah, let's kill that thing and throw it in the dumpster. Yeah, because it's not really, doesn't have a right to life yet. It's that 6 week number, magical, that somehow makes it a life worth preserving. So it says here, Trump maintains that even some anti-abortion activists believe the 6 week ban before many women even know they're pregnant is too harsh. So Trump is saying that the 6 week ban is too harsh, that according to some anti-abortion activists, think that is too harsh. Why is he even saying that? It says here, the country's leading anti-abortion group, Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America, wants GOP presidential candidates to advocate for a 15-week federal ban. Its president, Marjorie Dannenfelser, said anything less is, quote, unacceptable to the pro-life movement. And what do you think is, and do you think it's unacceptable to the 14-week fetus? Do you think the 14-week fetus will find that acceptable, that it's the 15-week ban? What do you think the 14-week fetus thinks about this? And these people claim to be Christians, so what do you think their God thinks about the 14-week fetus? Does he think that it's you can get rid of it if it that is, you know, expendable? Does their God believe that a 14-week fetus can be terminated? I wonder. So it says here, Trump campaign spokesman Steve Chung noted that Dannenfelser's group has praised Trump's presidency as the, quote, most consequential in American history for the pro-life cause, unquote. Other activists aren't as firm, however. And it's sad to say, you know, that's how how little these people have in terms of power to overcome. You know, they praise Trump for being the most pro-life or most consequential in American history for the pro-life cause. Really, you know, it's like, you know, it's like somebody, like a basketball team playing the Boston Celtics many years ago. I don't know how the Boston Celtics are now. I don't care about basketball anymore, but let's say back in the 50s, you have a team that plays the Boston Celtics, and your team is getting trounced by the Celtics, but a couple of guys on your team scored three baskets. And then there was one guy who scored four baskets, and they were the only ones who scored. And then you got trounced like 100 to 20. And you go, yeah, the guy who scored four baskets, he's the most consequential shooter in the game. He's the one who did the most damage to the Boston Celtics. That's the same thing. It's like no ambition, no sense of let's conquer. And I think that's why this thing was posted, this article, on the 15th of September, the day that the colony of Connecticut died, which represents the conqueror of the North. Let me get back down here. I wanted to read something here. It says here, another person, Kim Lehman, the former president of Iowa Right to Life, and also an RNC member, says the issue should be left to the states. Again, another federalist or pro-federalism person. We need someone who is going to stand up for life and not just be a mouthpiece, unquote, said Lehman, who was not endorsed a GOP primary candidate, but I believe our people are best served when this decision is made from the ground up. But I believe our people are best served when this decision is made from the ground up. In other words, federalism, you know, let's decide it at the state level, at the, quote, local level. And when we say local, we're talking about states that sometimes are big enough to be countries of their own. So she's saying our people, who is our people? The American people are best served when this decision is made from the ground up. But what about the fetuses? How are they best served? If a California fetus has the people around his local neighborhood deciding that abortion is okay in California, how is that fetus best served by this mindset? That's why the country's dead. Because it's moronic thinking. Either you believe in something or you don't. You don't. And now the next paragraph is so ironic. Democrats have unified around calls to protect abortion rights, seeing it as an issue of strength in 2024. So Democrats don't go around compromising. They don't say, okay, you're right. 15 weeks. After 15 weeks, it's murder to kill that fetus thingy. 15 weeks. well, let's compromise. Or can we make it 20? You know, just, you know, because you're saying 15, so I'm coming back with 20, and then maybe we can meet in the middle at 17 and a half. They don't think like that. They go all out, and they do their stupid protests, and their ignorant, events on the streets and stuff. And they don't go around saying, no, let's make it 17 and a half weeks instead of 15. They don't do that. They let's protect the right of a woman to terminate the pregnancy because it's her right. Who cares about the fetus? We don't care because it's a defenseless thing. We don't care about that. It doesn't vote. It doesn't do anything. It's just an inconvenience. Let's get rid of it. So they are not compromising on anything. They are radical. And I needed to share all of this because it is just an example of what is being held against Trump. Trump is being judged because of this, and he is going to pay the price, because you can't have your cake and eat it too, and the fact that even after all that has happened, he's still clinging to the art of the deal, wheeling and dealing with human lives, literally. So let me just continue speaking of Trump. I wanted to share last time about something that I've noticed in him for a long time, and I figure that a lot, maybe other people have noticed it, but it's interesting to me that I've never heard anyone explicitly talk about it. But I think that everyone notices it if you point it out. I still don't understand why no one talks about it, but I have noticed for a long time that when Trump is talking and giving a speech, that he usually tilts his head. And I was trying to look at pictures of him, trying to find them online to kind of confirm this, but it always seemed to be leaning in a certain, to a certain side. So he starts talking, and from what I could see in the pictures to confirm, is that he always tilts his head, starts tilting his head to the right. I could be wrong on this, but all I have noticed for a long time is he tilts his head. I'm still not 100% sure which side he tends to favor, but I think it's his right side. I went to this website that talks about body language, and this website is actually the domain name is bodylanguagematters.com, all, you know, together, bodylanguagematters.com. And they have an article called Head Tilt, Meaning in Body Language. It says here, when it comes to tilting the head in body language, there are usually only two or three meanings. If this is your first time reading about the meaning of body language, we need to first understand the context you see the head tilt, as this will give us a bigger clue as to why you spotted it in the first place. Tilting the head to one side can be a way of demonstrating interest or agreement. Holding your head in a tilted position is an interesting signal that means you're receptive to what the person who is speaking is saying. And then let me go all the way down here. They start giving all these examples. But later on it says, what does it mean when you see head tilt left or right? Head tilts have the same meaning as head tilts to the left and head tilts to the right. The most common interpretation of head tilt is that you're interested in what they have to say. It's also possible that they are part of an overall nonverbal message, such as a shy person looking down while listening to someone extroverted. Let me see if I... I did see here, and I lost it. Okay, here we go. A tilt to the right is often associated with expressing sympathy or showing emotional engagement with a subject or person they're interacting with. So when Trump is doing the head tilt thing to the right, what he's basically saying is, I empathize with you. I am showing, as it says here, emotional engagement. Like, I feel you. Like, I want you to like me, and I want you to feel that I am empathetic or sympathetic to your emotions. That's what he's doing. And that's part of his art of the deal mindset, where he tries to kind of reach across the aisle in a certain way to reach out to the person and get them to convince them. And I think this is genuine. It's not a like a fake thing, but it's a constant effort from inside of him to reach out to you, to let you know I like you, or I want to like you, and I want you to like me, and I want you to know that I connect with you, and that I feel your emotions, I feel your pain, and I want to reach out and connect with you. That's what he's constantly doing. So he's not a man of and yes, empathy is good and all that, but the fact that he does it so often, and the head tilts are sometimes very, very extreme. It just shows like an exaggerated effort to reach out to you. And that's because that is kind of like a bad habit he picked up with his art of the deal, because he's trying to connect with you to feel your emotions, to kind of gain your trust, so that you will be willing to compromise with him, and so that he will also kind of get a sense of what you want, so that he can offer it to you in that art of the deal. I hope I'm making sense. It's like the sort of connecting to make a deal. And the problem with that is that it kind of leads to a person who is not there to fulfill a conviction. So sometimes he talks like a conqueror who doesn't compromise. But it's all just the talk. And then at the end of the day, he starts reaching out to people and compromising. And that's why he's around himself with such terrible people, constantly making wrong decisions, praising people he should not be praising. All that praising that he does, what he kept saying, Mitch McConnell is great, Paul Ryan is great, all these people are great, is his way of trying to reach out to people. And so that he can then negotiate with them and use them and work with them to get as much as he can or wants to get. Instead of saying, no, you are evil. You are good. You are evil. And I'm going to fight you till the end, uncompromisingly. He doesn't think like that. That's why he does the head tilt. And I find that very significant, because we were talking about this young lady called Amris, and she was young. The parents were saying in the advert, in the St. Jude's advert, that she, being very young, apparently started having a head tilt. Like the father noticed that she had a bit of a head tilt, and he said to his wife, you know, the young girl's mother, honey, there's something wrong. I don't know what it is, but there's something wrong. Because he could see that there was something wrong with the head tilt. Just like there's something wrong with Trump when he does the head tilt. It's just a manifestation of something wrong with him. So, and the head tilt that Amber's had was because she had a tumor in one side of her brain. And that's why she felt maybe it was a weight thing or something, but it kind of prompted her to tilt her head a little bit in one direction, her little head. And I believe there's a connection. Then Ambrose eventually, passed away. And in the same way, you know, America died, and in the same way, Trump will die. And I know it's not a coincidence. And I wouldn't be surprised if his death is going to come from something in his head, in one side of his head. So I felt prompted that we have to mention all of this. And speaking of this art of the deal and the head tilting and the empathy and the reaching out rubbish, we also wanted to talk about this story. Let me see if I can find it here. This was posted on October 6th, the day before this recording, and 2023. And it's on the gatewaypundit.com. And the title of it, and the person who wrote it, his name, interestingly enough, is Elijah Schaefer. Elijah, like the prophet in the Bible, Elijah Schaefer. And the, I guess that's how you pronounce it, Schaefer, it's spelled S-H-A-F-F-E-R, so you could maybe theoretically pronounce it Schaffer, but I don't think he pronounces it like that. The thing is that the article is entitled "Wow, Donald Trump endorsed Jim Jordan for Speaker of the House." So, as you may know, if you're listening to this around the time of this recording, there was a Republican congressman called Matt Gaetz who decided to filed a motion to kick the Speaker of the House, Mike McCarthy, out of office. And it was because back in January of 2023, when the Republicans came in and they were trying to pick a speaker, there was this big controversy in voting because the more radical, and I say that in a good way, the more radical Republicans like Gaetz and others did not want a wishy-washy speaker. And again, without going into too much detail, there should be no vote for speaker to begin with. We have said that a million times. It was a big mistake, one of the stupid mistakes of the many stupid mistakes by the founding fathers in America. Back in the 18th century, they should have never done that. It's a stupid mistake. One of the many mistakes in the Constitution. One of the terrible document with tons of mistakes. One of them being the Speaker of the House. But the thing is, because there is a Speaker position, they were voting on it. They couldn't decide. And Trump began to endorse McCarthy. He kept calling everybody in the House who was Republican, who wanted to listen to him. And he was trying to tell them, pick McCarthy, pick McCarthy, pick McCarthy. Why? Because McCarthy was more or less the party's choice. He wanted to ingratiate himself with the party. He wanted to ingratiate himself with McCarthy. And he was thinking also long-term, or quote, long-term, when I become president again in 2024, I want McCarthy, or I don't know why I call him Mike McCarthy. His name is Kevin McCarthy, but for some reason, I always associate him with Mike. There used to be a football head coach for the Green Bay Packers, I think, who was called Mike McCarthy. Maybe that's the confusion, but I think it goes beyond that. I always associate him with Mike Pence, Miguelito Pence. It's like they are two sides of the same coin. They even look a little bit alike, at least to my eyes, and there's something about them, like they're very similar. They're both snaky and hypocritical, and I don't know. That's why I call him Mike. I apologize. His literal name is Kevin McCarthy. But the thing is that Trump kept promoting Kevin McCarthy, who was a terrible choice. Everybody knows he's a rhino. Everybody. You don't have to be a political expert living in Washington to know Kevin McCarthy is a weak rhino, Republican in name only, rhino. But So because of the controversy, eventually they made a deal, you know, the art of the deal. So they made a deal. Well, okay, we're going to vote for you, but you have to do this when you during your time as speaker. So there was an agreement, and Mike McCarthy signed it. And because he signed it, a lot of the Republicans who were opposed to him voted for him, and he was put in place. So Trump could have fought right then and there. We don't want wishy-washy people anymore. Let's fight for a person who will do the right thing all the time. No. He wanted to play the game, the Republican Party game. He plays the party game a lot. So they put him in, but the condition was that if McCarthy did not fulfill everything in that agreement that he signed, any one member of the House could file a motion to provoke a vote on the floor to decide whether he should or should not continue as Speaker of the House. Just one person. So Matt Gaetz kept saying, "You don't shave up, I'm going to file the motion." And Kevin McCarthy so arrogantly kept saying, "You know, bring it on, bring it on, USOB, bring it on." And Matt Gaetz brought it on, and he filed the motion. And we know the story that Kevin McCarthy got kicked out, and he is the shortest serving speaker in the House since 1876. Not a coincidence. 1876 was the year we've talked about in previous recordings, the year of the Great Compromise of 1876, when Rutherford B. Hayes compromised with the Southern Democrats to win the electoral college vote, because we went in great detail about that. He won by one vote. There was a lot of controversy with some Southern states that had been suppressing the black vote. Long story short, he compromised with the Southern Democrats in order to win the election as and become president. And the condition was, you withdraw federal troops from the South and you let us oppress black people once again. And Rutherford B. Hayes said, "All right, the Republican Rutherford B. Hayes." And there was a death there. So it's interesting that Kevin McCarthy, who represents that whole compromise thing, is the shortest-serving speaker since that year. A year that there was a death in the Republican Party in 1876. A death. Something very important in the Republican Party died in 1876, when the Republican Party, which was created to protect black people, that was the core reason for its existence. When the Republican Party sold black people down the river, just to maintain power, or get into power, that's the day that the Republican Party died died in a significant way, not completely, but died in a significant way, and it never recovered from that, never. And I think I've shared with you that I do remember one very cold night, I believe it was January of 2021, the first Saturday of January 2021. Which was January 2nd, 2021. I don't recall the exact date, but it was around that time. And I believe it was January 2nd. I had a watch that was all red that I had bought some while back. A red face, red wristband, everything red. And that night, as I was walking around 9, 10 p.m. in Manhattan, and there's a long story why I had to do that every Saturday night. It was hell. It was during the time of the pandemic nonsense. And I had to wait until it was late to get back home. Long story. But the thing is, I was just suffering the torture of walking around in the freezing cold of January in New York. Outside, because I couldn't go inside anywhere because of the mask nonsense and all that. So I just stayed outside for hours. So I was walking around waiting for for 10 p.m. to come around. Long story why. The thing is that as I was walking, my watch suddenly stopped. It just stopped. And I said to myself, why is this happening? Why did the watch just suddenly die on me? And it was not a cheap watch. At that time, I think it was the most expensive watch I'd ever bought. It wasn't that expensive, but at least in my standards, it was the most expensive watch I had ever bought. And I said, why did this happen? And then it's as if a voice came to me. It's, I felt a voice saying, the Republican Party just died right now. And because the Republican Party is known, you know, as the red, it's always represented by the color red. The Democrats are represented by the color blue. And it's as if that night when my watch died, the Republican Party officially died. And it was around that time that the January 6th thing happened, when Miguelito Pence, like a good traitor, did his thing where he did not contest the electoral votes, which is ironic because back in 1876, the Republicans did fight hard to win back the vote, the Electoral College votes that the South had stolen by suppressing the black vote. So they had a little more guts back in 1876. Eventually they compromised and died, but at least they fought at the beginning. This Miguelito Pence just did not want to fight. And so this time the Republican Party tried to fight in 1876 and then compromised severely. In 2021, on January 6th, Miguelito Pence, as a representative of what the Republican Party had become, did not even try to fight the blatant fraud. And he was part of the ticket that had been fraudulently made to lose the election. And he didn't even want to fight that. You know, it's like you're part of, you just got cheated. You played a football game and you got cheated, and you have a way to fight that. You were the ones who lost. You were part of the team that got cheated out of victory. You would think that you would be the first person to fight, to have that wrong corrected. And he didn't even do that. And to me, that was a confirmation, yeah, the Republican Party has died. And it's sad that Trump keeps playing the Republican Party game. Because when Kevin McCarthy got thrown out, his choice, his pick, instead of saying, I'm disappointed about Kevin McCarthy, he never said that because he doesn't want to admit he was wrong. He said they started offering him the position of speaker. Some people suggested he could be the Speaker of the House because in the Constitution, it doesn't say that the Speaker has to be an elected representative in Congress. He can be anybody. You know, it could be Joe Schmo, you know, walking, past Capitol Hill. They could just grab him and say, hey, you're going to be the Speaker of the House. I mean, there's no restriction on that. So he could theoretically be the, quote, Speaker of the House. And he was being proposed as the option. And his answer when he was asked, would you accept that? He said, I'll do whatever is best for the Republican Party and the country. And I'm willing to serve in any way I can. Why do you phrase it like that, you stupid idiot? Why would you say, I'm going to do what's best for the Republican Party and the country? So he's still playing the Republican Party game. He still thinks that he will do the art of the deal, and he wants to ingratiate himself with enough Republican people to, you know, you're not here. So he doesn't understand the Republican Party is dead. He doesn't even understand that. The Republican Party that stood by on the sidelines watching him getting the election stolen from him, who did not lift a finger for him, and he still thinks that it's a party worth fighting for, instead of fighting the party and fighting the system. The same people who betrayed him, stabbed him in the back, and then he turns around and pretends like nothing happened, and now he wants to play the party game again. It is very disappointing, but the thing is that now, let me go to what's being said in this story that I was mentioning from thegatewaypundit.com. It says, in a recent development, Representative Troy Nehls, Republican of Texas, announced that former President Donald Trump is endorsing Representative Jim Jordan, Republican of Ohio, for Speaker of the House. And when I read this story that he was endorsing Jim Jordan, I said, pardon my French, but I said, what the hell? Jim Jordan, Jim Jordan is a big talker, but at the end he is nothing more than a rhino. Let me see if I can find the story here. I'm going to read from a despicable website. I hope I'm not misrepresenting this site, but from what I can see, it's a kind of a left wing nut job site. It's Mediaite.com, and they have an article here from October 3rd, 2023. It says, extremely despondent Jim Jordan tells CNN McCarthy didn't deserve this. So in an exchange with CNN, Jordan said, I thought it was unfair to Kevin. Kevin, I think, has done a fine job, and he and I came in together. He's a good man, and he didn't deserve this in my judgment. And so this is the guy that Trump is supporting now. It's just compromising and compromising and playing the game. He thinks Jim Jordan has the greatest chance of winning, so he's just trying to side with whom he thinks is most convenient for the party and then his own political interests in future. And Jim Jordan is interesting. His name says Jordan, which makes you think of the River Jordan, and we've talked about the symbolic meaning of that. Crossing the Jordan is crossing into a new dimension where you're going to lead to a transformation of things, where you're going to really regenerate everything. And it talks about, you know, going, crossing the Jordan to achieve a great conquest of a promised land. And Jim Jordan has the name of Jordan, but he never crosses his own surname. He never crosses the Jordan. He just dips his toes in the water, pretends like he's going to go in, like, I'm going in, and, you know, and then he pulls back, I'm going in, he pulls back, and he's at the edge of the river doing that all day. All day. That's what he's doing all day. So it's interesting to me that the name of the person who wrote this article on the Gateway Pundit, his name is Elijah, and Elijah has to do, you know, Elijah and Elisha in the Bible are kind of like, Elijah is the guy who never really crossed the Jordan. He didn't really commit to crossing the Jordan, and Elisha did. If you read in the Bible, you'll see what I'm trying to say, I think. Elijah, in a sense, was a failure. He didn't want to do certain things according to the Bible. And in the Bible, it says that Elisha ended up doing the things that Elijah refused to do because it was, for him, going too far. It was going beyond his comfort zone or what he wanted to go. So he just said, I'm not crossing that line. So interesting that Elijah is the name of the person who wrote this. And that is representative of Trump. He does not want to cross the Jordan, so he's picking a guy, but he does have he acts like he's a Jordan crosser, so he has the name of a Jordan crosser, but he doesn't do what Jordan crossers do, and he disdains Jordan crossers. So now, just to pretend to be a Jordan crosser, he picks a Jim Jordan, but Jim Jordan is not a Jordan crosser, just like him. We've shared all these things, and you may wonder what was the point of sharing all these details. The reason why we're sharing this is that we talked about abortion and how abortion is kind of like a litmus test of the state of the country and its people and its culture. And you can see in Trump's attitude how even the people who are supposed to be the most bold and the ones who are going to lead us to the promised land, the heroes that we have looked to take us to where we need to go, that even these people are not willing to be radical about the principle. It's always compromising, always trying to find a way to get as much as they can without demanding too much, because they don't want us. They don't want to be radicals. The Democrats don't think about it in those terms. They just go, "Oh, everybody can afford. Let's afford." And even at, you know, 8.5, 9 months, even as the baby's coming out, if he hasn't come out all the way, you know, bah, let's decapitate that thing and then throw it in the rubbish bin. Who cares? They're radical. They don't start compromising about numbers. Okay, let's just have a 20-week ban or 25-week ban. Okay, let's leave it up to the state so that if I want to, if I'm pro-abortion, I can just go live in California. And if you like your anti-abortion stuff, then you stay in Texas or Florida. They don't think like that. No, everybody, free abortion for everybody on demand. And it should be federalized. So they think in that absolute term. But conservatives don't think like that. And the problem is, yes, I understand. If the public is not for it, then what you do is you evangelize the public. You lay the legal and metaphysical framework, foundation, all over which you're building, on top of which you're building. You start explaining. But see, the thing is, to build that metaphysical foundation, what do you have to do at the end of the day? You have to embarrass the U.S. Constitution. Why? Because to lay the foundation of why the abortion of a fetus is a violation of a human right, you have to establish the right to life. And to establish the right to life, you have to expose the fact that it's not in the Constitution. Then you have to make the Constitution look bad. You have to make the Founding Fathers look bad. You have to say how stupid and moronic and nearsighted they were in not understanding the concept of the right to life, that they didn't even come close. And as we've said a million times, a lot of morons would argue, well, the thing is, abortion didn't exist back in those days because people were more civilized, and the Founding Fathers could have never imagined that we were going to do these barbaric operations to destroy human life. Well, you know, and there are two problems with that argument. Number one, conservatives keep claiming over and over again how the Founding Fathers were so wise that they understood the corruptibility of human nature. Well, if they understood how corruptible human nature is, why couldn't they envision days like this? Oh, well, that's just going too far. Well, whatever. Then they were not that wise. Then stop saying that. It's annoying. Number two, even if abortion had never happened, even if the procedure of abortion had never been invented, for lack of a better term, still, the Founding Fathers never protected in the Constitution the right to life of the born. We've said this a million times. The right to life of the born is not there. It is there in some very limited ways. The right to the freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly. All these things are manifestations of the right to life. But the right to life per se, in essence, is not there. There's no metaphysical foundation on which you can stand and say the Constitution protects life in these forms, and therefore that includes human fetuses. There's nothing to stand on. So they didn't even do that. And why they didn't even do that? Because they said, let's just put in a few things here just to get a Constitution going, and let's leave everything else to the states. Federalism. Again, federalism, that evil monster of federalism. The foundation was never laid because the people who could have laid it would have had to first accept that there was something wrong with the foundation of this country. That the right to life was never, never stated as something worth protecting in the Constitution. And if we want to, see, abortion is not more, it's more than just, okay, let's pass a law. Because the law that can then be repealed 3 months later, Democrats take over the House or whatever, then they, you know, nullify the bill from the previous Congress, and then abortion is back. It's not a matter of just passing a law. It is defining the right to life in clear terms, unambiguous terms, with these parameters that we've described in detail in previous recordings, and from the early recordings we talked in at length about that right to life. It's a matter of laying them out in clarity, and then putting them in the Constitution. It has to be a constitutional thing. It can't just be a bill, because a bill can be repealed or changed from year to year, from Congress to Congress, or whatever. It has to be a core thing that is so foundational that to remove it, you have to really change the foundation of the country, because it's such a core principle. And again, the right to property, that's another right. The morons, the founding father morons, did not put in the Constitution. The right to property is not protected in the Constitution. That's why you have all these excesses. Now the government, you know, taking your money and doing all these things. You know, the death taxes, you know, you die, you have to pay a tax even after you're dead. Inheritance taxes and all these things that are manifestations of a violation of the right to property. They didn't put anything there to protect private property. In the Constitution of the country that has been the most capitalist country probably in the history of mankind, it does not have the right to property. And that's why we're descending into this soft socialism that we have now. And the economic decay and collapse that we are experiencing, because the right to property was never defined and protected. So the thing is, going back to abortion, the right to life needed to be defined and clarified. And somebody has to go out and speak it and explain, okay, you know why the fetus has to be aborted? What would happen if somebody leaves a kid, a baby, in a basket on your front door, and you go out to work, you know, the next morning, you open the door and you see this baby left in, you know, at your front door, but you have to go to work. Are you going to just step over the baby, over the basket, get in your car and go to work and pretend like the baby was not there? No, it's not your baby. It's not your fault the kid is there. You know, it's who knows who left it there. But you, at that moment, you forget about going to work. You take the baby, bring it inside, and then you call the police or child services or whatever you want to call. And let's say you're living in a rural neighborhood, rural area, you know, where no one is going to come and pick up the baby for days. Are you just going to leave him outside to die? No, you're going to feed him as best you can. You're going to take care of him. Even if it was an inconvenience left at your doorstep, you see the value of that life, and how, despite the inconvenience being brought to you, you do your best to save that life and, you know, preserve it. You start explaining that. Then you go to the example. Well, it's the same thing as when a baby is deposited in your womb. It's the same story. You might say, well, I didn't want the baby. Well, that baby in the example of the front door, you didn't want that baby either, but it was put in your realm of responsibility, fairly or unfairly. But the baby can't do a thing about it. The baby can't say, well, I'm sorry I was left here. Let me just go find my way back home and put myself at my mother's doorstep so that she will take care of me. I mean, the baby can't do a thing. The baby is defenseless. So you start explaining that. And then you go to the example, you start explaining what the right to life is. It means the ability to, we explain all these concepts, the ability of motion, of free motion, the ability to reproduce, the ability, and all these things. And then you start applying them. These principles have repercussions at so many levels, but if you apply them at the basest level, the basic level, then you start seeing, well, oh, I'm looking here at something that applies to animals. And then you give the leftist an example. What would you think, for example, of a guy who takes a puppy? You know, maybe a 1-week-old puppy. It's there, but he doesn't want to take care of the puppy because it means buying more puppy food and having to walk the puppy, all the inconveniences of this extra puppy in his life. Do you think that if the guy came, took the puppy, and just twisted its neck and killed it right then and there, do you think that would be okay? And all the liberals would go, oh no, that would be evil. Well, so you're saying that eliminating a life form just because it's inconvenient is wrong? Yes, it's wrong. Well, isn't it the same thing when you have an inconvenient pregnancy and it's going to mess up your life? Is the inconvenience enough justification to end that life form? Forget it that it's a human. It's a life form. A puppy is not a human, yet you care about that thing, that little thing. But you don't care about this other life form, and then you appeal to the other thing. Well, I gave you an example of a puppy. You said, "How dare you kill the puppy?" But you were never a puppy, because if you were a puppy, then you'd be a dog right now, and I would not be talking to you, and you would not know, understand a word I'm saying to you. You'd just be tilting your head. The way dogs do when you're talking to them. So you were never a puppy. But interestingly enough, you were a fetus once. You were one of those things that you're okay with terminating if it's an inconvenience. So if your mother had thought that you were an inconvenience to her life, then according to your own theory, she had every right to exterminate you. You were a fetus once, but your mother said, what the hell? Let's give this thing a chance. So she gave birth to you after 9 months of inconvenience and who knows how many hours of labor pains. She gave birth to, this thing called you, and you started to grow. And now you as an adult, you're denying other fetuses the opportunity your mother gave to you. And you're saying, yeah, if my mother had wanted to abort me, that would have been fine with me. That's what you're saying. You were a fetus once, but yet you don't care about fetuses. You never were a puppy, yet you would go to the ends of the earth to protect a puppy from animal cruelty.
Well, the thing is, the puppy was born.
Oh, okay. So you're saying that if I let's say that my female dog, and I will not use the word that would correspond with that, that my female dog is, let's say you find out your female dog is pregnant, but you don't want to deal with that. And let's say you could safely do a procedure where you could abort the puppies. Would you be okay with that? Would you be okay with that? They're not born yet, so they're for a game, right? And maybe they are, I don't know how long the gestation period is for puppies, for dogs, but let's say that they're 1 day away from being born and it's too much inconvenience. Let's say that you could do a safe procedure where you could abort all the puppies and just throw them in the rubbish bin. Just take them out, just yank them out of the dog's womb and throw them out. Would you be okay with that? And if they can tell you, they would be okay with that. I can bet you they'd be lying through their teeth. And they would not have the courage to say it out loud because they would sound so evil and so pro-animal cruelty. And then you just project, yes. So I am proposing to you a constitutional system that protects the right of those puppies you care so much about, that you give a damn about so much, but at the same time protects human fetuses because we can all agree that a human fetus is more valuable than all those puppies that you were protecting so fiercely. See, you start laying the argument, and then people will be opposed. But then if you're a so-called Christian, you're a conservative Christian, you believe in your God, the God who parted the sea and whose son came to the earth and walked on water, you believe all these things. Don't you think that then if you really believe in that God, that once you lay out the arguments, you set the principles, that God that you so fervently talk about, don't you think that God would have the power to transform the environment and the attitudes of people and get them to open their eyes to what all the things, all the wisdom that's coming out of your mouth and produce a change where people will say, yes, what the hell were we thinking doing this barbaric thing that is worthy of pagan superstition, pagan ritualism, and barbaric pagan ritualism. See, those are the conquerors. Those are the Jordan Crossers. Those are the ones that take over cities and conquer nations. But there's none of that in America. And you would say, well, if you're talking about it, why don't you do it? Well, the thing is, you need a critical mass of people. See, you can have all the ideas, you can have all the concepts, but if no one agrees with you, if there's no critical mass of an army to fight the battle, then the battle cannot be fought. One swallow does not a summer make. And that's what we had in America, just very few people willing to listen to the truth. And the people like Trump who were put in a position, in an Esther-like position, in a position where they could affect transformational change. People who had the opportunity to hear people like the truth seekers who are saying all these things. And these people who had the opportunity said no. And the people who support them don't care that Trump and others said no to the truth. They don't care because they're not seeking the truth themselves. They don't hold Trump to account for all these things. They're still going to support him. They still plan to vote for him. And no one says, okay, I give up. Why are we doing this? Why are we playing this game constantly of just settling and settling and settling and compromising? And willing to let fetuses die, literally and figuratively, just so that we can maybe have a Pyrrhic victory that is taken away at the next turn. So, and the thing is with Matt Gaetz, he's an interesting fellow, the more I've listened to him, because he had the guts to stand up and throw Kevin McCarthy out, and unfortunately he's going to be replaced with Kevin McCarthy 2.0. But at least he did the fight. Now it's all useless because the country's dead, but you know, at least he tried. But one thing I did want to mention about him is that he went on an interview with Maria Bartiromo, a reporter from I forget what financial news channel, and she's an interesting lady, very interesting lady, Maria Bartiromo. But I was kind of saddened when I found out that in her interview with Matt Gaetz, the representative, she started attacking him for attacking McCarthy, as if to say, aren't you kind of like shooting yourself yourselves in the foot, you're making things more difficult for your party and blah blah blah. And Matt Gaetz kept fighting back, and another thing that she didn't like was that he was angry at McCarthy for doing all these compromises on spending, and then he started saying something very interesting. It's almost as if he's heard a few of the audio snippets. I know he hasn't, but it's almost as if he has. And I know, even though a lot of people don't hear these audio snippets, they are hearing it. They're just hearing it in a different way. They don't realize it, but they are hearing it. They're hearing them, these audio snippets. The thing is that he said, well, the thing is, I am sick and tired of having to do all these compromises with the budget and with these humongous budget bills. We should not have it like that, because then it's so subject to all these wheelings and dealings that are done by the powerful people who put together this package. And then we, the little people, the little representatives, just vote yay or nay on the whole thing that was created and designed by some people in some smoke-filled room. So he said, let's have small bills. Instead of having one big budget bill, let's split the bill budget into a lot of bills, small bills that we can vote on individually. And I said, oh my goodness, he has listened to the audio snippets, maybe not literally, but spiritually he has listened to the audio snippets, because that's what we've been saying all this time. There should be a constitutional requirement that no bill can be more than, and I'm not sure of the number, but let's say 10 or 20 pages long. There has to be a limit on the size of every bill. And if it's not enough, 20 pages is not enough, then split it into, if it's a 300 page bill, you can't, you know, make it any smaller, then I'm sorry, we'll just have to create 15, 20 page bills. But that's the only way to start controlling all this crazy spending, because you're just presented with one big package full of compromises done by the Speaker and the Senate Majority Leader and the Senate Minority Leader and the RNC Chairman, the DNC Chairman, and all these people behind the scenes. All these compromises. You're presented with this humongous bill, and you're supposed to say yay or nay. And you're supposed to, if you're loyal to the party, you say you will vote yay, because you know that if you vote nay, then the Republican Party is going to get back at you at some point and punish you for having rebelled against the party. So it's ridiculous to have these spending bills that are these humongous things. It should be every budget, every expense should be in a separate bill, and then you vote on it individually. And on top of that, you add on top of that the fact that there should be no parties to begin with, no Speaker of the House. We've laid out all of that. We've talked about the castration of the party system, how a new constitution would have ended that. Then Trump would not be playing party games, trying to fight for the interest of the Republican Party. Who gives a rodent's derriere about the party? It should be about principles. And if we had redone the American Constitution, we would have had a system with no parties, where people do the right thing, and where people are their own bosses, their own individuals, each person. And that's the thing with the Speaker. I mean, Mike McCarthy, or I keep calling him Mike, Kevin McCarthy is a guy from California. I mean, who voted him in and gave him all the power he had to control so much stuff? Why? Why? He's all the way in California. I have nothing to do with him. Why is he having so much influence on my life more than all the people voted in from the state I'm in? Why? Every person should be one representative, one vote. And if they want to be influential, it should be on the merit of their ideas, not because they were given a position of power. And all this sad nonsense about, you know, the deal that they did when McCarthy accepted the deal and became the Speaker. And, you know, why all this wheeling and dealing? And you know why? Because the morons called the Founding Fathers said in the Constitution that every Congress will lay out their own rules and their own regulations and procedures. So we have all this crazy nonsense where every Congress decides these are the rules now, these are the rules, and then it's all this nonsense. Instead of having a very simple, straightforward system, they never laid out the legislative system clearly. And on top of that, we have, you know, why was Roe v. Wade the law of the land? starting in 1973, I think it was, all this time. Why was abortion legalized? Because the founding fathers, just like they were very unclear about how the legislative system should work, they never worried about laying it out. They said, oh, every Congress decides on their own. You know, we wash our hands, we don't care. In the same way, they were very ambiguous about the Supreme, the legislative, the judicial branch, to the point that now the judicial branch, and we'll talk about that someday, maybe not in this audio snippet, but the case of Marbury versus Madison. And that happened when the founding fathers were still around. In fact, Madison, in Marbury versus Madison, was James Madison, a founding father. So that case that we'll talk about maybe someday, illustrated very clearly to the country when it was starting, we don't know what the hell the judicial branch is supposed to do. We really don't know. It's not in the Constitution. It's not clear. Instead of being a wake-up call, like, okay, let's fix this before it gets bad. Let's decide what are the limits and the role of the judicial branch, and let's put it in the Constitution and get it done right now that we are a young nation. No, whatever. We just kept going. And now we have judges who can overturn a law. Why? And then the legislative branch has no power. There's no check and balance the other way around. The legislative branch cannot overturn a judge's verdict. Why? Because the founding fathers, the morons called the founding fathers, never put it there, never clarified it. Then that's how we ended up with abortion being the law of the land. Because some Supreme Court decided at some point, hey, let's overturn any law banning abortion at the state level. And that was it. The state of Texas, which was the first one, the one most directly affected in that lawsuit, Roe v. Wade, could do a thing. Washington could not do a thing. No one, no state could do anything. Because some group of judges decided that's it. And then years later, another group of judges says, no, let's overturn what the other judges said. And then who knows what's going to happen afterwards. It is madness. It is so sad that because we never committed to crossing the Jordan, we ended up aborting the American dream. The hope that we had as a country, it all died because we never ended the party system. We never committed to transforming the Constitution, and we never let go of the sacred cows, because you can't cross the Jordan with the sacred cows. They're just too big, too clumsy. You can't cross with the sacred cows. They just get in the way, and we didn't want to do that. We ended up aborting the American dream. And that's why we continue compromising, playing the game, thinking that somehow we're going to get back on track, you know, that we fell off the train and we're trying to catch up to the train and we're going to grab it and get back in the train. The train is gone. It's over. And all these people are playing games, and Trump is going to pay the consequences of his gameplay. He is going to pay the price. And all the people who support him are going to mourn him and say, oh, this is so sad. And then they're going to blame the world and everybody else and not realize, no, this is a manifestation of the death that you represent. You aborted the American dream. You aborted everything that the truth had for this country. And that's why you have abortion in the land. That's why you can't defeat the abortion thing. That's why you keep fighting abortion the wrong way. And that's why we are dead as a nation. And so I guess, in a sense, the thread running through all these things we talked about have to do with abortion. And how we have fought abortion and how we were unwilling to kill the cows that needed to be killed to save the babies. And not only save babies, save fetuses, but save the nation. Yeah, there are no Jordan crossers. So, and as long as there are no Jordan crossers, we're going to have abortion. The abortion of dreams, the abortion of fetuses, the abortion of everything. And that's why over a period, I would say, of 30 years, and I think that in 3 years, we might be seeing some dramatic effects. But maybe I'm being very optimistic. I think over a period of 30 years, the American nation is going to decline, until it will become nothingness. Right now, it's a third world country. It just has first world money, but it's a third world country. And it's like, for example, when some athletes come from poor neighborhoods, but they're very good athletes and they become professionals and they get paid millions of dollars, so they start, you know, making, you know, from extreme poverty, they become millionaires overnight, and they take this money and they start spending it, and then maybe they have an injury, their career ends, and all the money they had, it's just blown away. It's kind of the same thing. It's a third world mentality with first world money. But just like with an athlete that does not know how to manage his money because he's just, he's got intoxicated with the money that he's making, he will eventually blow it. And just like in the same way, America is going to erode its wealth. The wealth that was accumulated over so many decades is just going to slowly erode and evaporate. And then it will become obvious. They're going to say America is Argentina. They're going to say, mark my words, 20, 30 years from now, they're going to make comparisons between Argentina and America and say, you know, both countries have very similar declines. And America's just going to be a third world country. That's all there is to it, because it aborted the dream, because there were no Jordan crossers willing to kill the cows to spare the dream. Thank you very much for listening.